Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in 1 Samuel chapter 14, middle of the chapter, starting with verse 24, going to verse 52. We'll look at Saul's rash vow that he took in the middle of the Battle of Michmash. The first 23 verses of 1 Samuel 14 are our context. This is where Saul, and more particularly Jonathan, his son, beat the Philistines at the great Battle of Michmash. So we start now in 1 Samuel 14, verses 24 through 26. Now the men of Israel were hard-pressed on that day, for Saul had put the people under oath, saying, "Cursed be the man who eats food before evening, and until I have avenged myself on my enemies." So none of the people tasted food. All the people of the land entered the forest, and there was honey on the ground. When the people entered the forest, behold, there was a flow of honey, but no man put his hand to his mouth, for the people feared the oath. Now, why in verse 24 were the men of Israel hard-pressed? Well, they were hard-pressed because they were hungry. They had been fighting all during the day, and then as evening approached, they found honey on the ground, and they can't eat it because of this stupid oath, this rash oath that Saul had made. He said, "Cursed," Saul did, "cursed be the man who eats food before evening," cursing his own soldiers. Why did he do that? Well, he didn't want any time to be lost in the pursuit of the Philistines. Well, for that short-term advantage, he lost a lot of long-term advantage in his battle. So this proves that Saul was a lousy general as well as a lousy king. And remember, he didn't win this battle. It was Jonathan who won it by going up the crag there before the camp of the Philistines at Michmash in the previous chapter, or the previous half of this chapter. He and his armor bearer went up. Took a lot of guts to do what they did. They created panic in the Philistine camp, and because of that panic, the Israelites had won. Saul didn't have anything to do with it. But he did have a lot to do with enervating his troops. So in verse 25, all the people of the land, that's talking about Saul's soldiers, entered the forest, and that would be between Beth-Aven and Ajalon. We're going to look at that in a minute. That's sort of the field of battle here. Remember, the Philistines have scattered after this battle from Michmash. Michmash is right across the valley from Geba, and Geba is the apex of a triangle, the eastern apex of a triangle. Gibeah is at the southern of an equilateral triangle. Geba is at the southern base point, and Gideon is at the northern base point. So this is all in the area of Benjamin. If you go north of Michmash a little ways, 4 or 5 miles, you'll get to Beth-Aven, and then if you go west about 10 or 12 miles from Beth-Aven, it's actually west. Southwest, you'll get to Ajalon. So in this area, you see the field of battle is spread out because basically the Israelites are chasing down the Philistines, who are scattering and who are in full stage panic mode. They're not in an ordered retreat. They are being routed. The Israelites have got them, and Saul screws it up. Now, this oath, was it foolish? Well, I've been assuming it was. Let's look at that a little closer. Here's what John Gill says. "It may seem a little too hard and severe upon the people, and too imperious in him, in Saul, as well as imprudent, since a little refreshment would have animated and enabled them to have pursued their enemies with more ardor and rigor." Well, Gill sort of tippy-toes around the problem here. Well, let's look at some other learned opinion. Adam Clark goes more or less along with the way I'm thinking about this. Quote, "This was the very means of defeating his own intention, for as the people were exhausted for want of food, they could not continue the pursuit of their enemies. Had it not been for this foolish adjuration, there had been a greater slaughter of the Philistines." So Clark calls Saul's rash vow a foolish adjuration, which is just fancy English for a rash vow. Jonathan knew it was foolish. He said so in verse 30, which we'll get to in a minute. In chapter 14, Jonathan says this, "How much more, if only the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies which they found? For now the slaughter among the Philistines has not been great." Well, he's mentioning the spoil of their enemies. Not only honey found on the ground, but also all the food that was packed away in Philistine tents, which the Israelite soldiers came on. They couldn't eat it, and so they were hungry. Jameson Fawcett and Brown says about this rash oath, quote, "This rash and foolish denunciation distressed the people by preventing them taking such refreshments as they might get on the march and materially hindered the successful attainment of his own patriotic object." So Jameson Fawcett and Brown calls this vow that Saul made, or that he made his soldiers make, a rash and foolish denunciation. I think there's no question about it. Now, some details here. Verse 26, why is honey found on the ground? Honey on the ground that the people couldn't eat. What was honey being on the ground? Usually we think of honey being in beehives up in a tree somewhere. Well, here are some options. John Gill says that honeycombs were found on the ground often in Arabia. Judea is expressly said to be a land flowing with milk and honey. And so honey flows out of honeycombs, which back then, or in that area, were on the ground. Well, I don't know enough about bees and honeycombs to know that. Adam Clark explains it another way. He says that the honey dropped on the ground from the trees above. Quote, it seems to have dropped, the honey seems to have dropped from the trees on the ground. Honey dews, as they are called, are not uncommon in most countries, and this appears to have been something of this kind. I have seen honey in considerable quantity on the trees and long grass in the fields, and have often eaten of it. I take their word for it. For some reason, there is honey on the ground, either in combs or falling from the trees. And boy, honey, when you're hungry, pure sugar boost. Verse 25 in the NASB says there was a flow of honey. So does the Holman Christian Study Bible, a flow of honey. So honey was flowing like water. Jameson Fawcett Brown says this about this flowing of honey, quote, bees in the East are not, as in England, kept in hives. They are all in a wild state. The forest literally flow with honey. Large combs may be seen hanging on the trees as you pass along, full of honey. Well, I leave it to the agriculturalist to explain that. Somehow there was honey on the ground. 1 Samuel 14, verses 27 through 30. But Jonathan had not heard when his father put the people under oath. Therefore, he put out the end of his staff that was in his hand and dipped it in the honeycomb and put his hand to his mouth, and his eyes brightened. Then one of the people said, your father strictly put the people under oath, saying, cursed be the man who eats food today. And the people were weary. Then Jonathan said, my father has troubled the land. See now how my eyes have brightened because I tasted a little of this honey. How much more if only the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies which they found? For now the slaughter among the Philistines has not been great. So Jonathan is with another party fighting and pursuing the Philistines. He was away from his father when the father put the soldiers under oath not to eat. So Jonathan hadn't heard the oath when he put his staff in the honeycomb, ate it, and his eyes brightened. Why did his eyes brighten? Because honey is pure sugar, and that's pure energy, and I'm sure Jonathan was very hungry. Now notice in verse 29, Jonathan says outright, my father has troubled the land. Ooh, was that wise for Jonathan to say? Well, we can make an argument that it was not very wise. As a son, it showed no respect to his father. As a soldier, Jonathan showed no respect to his commanding officer. You say things like that too much, and pretty soon you might have mutiny or sedition on your hands. Other people say, well, there's nothing wrong for Jonathan to say that. After all, it was entirely true. But there's a lot of things that are true you ought not to say. Reminds me of somebody with ADD I knew in Beijing, and she said, we need to be truthful, we need to be truthful. And whenever she saw a fat Chinese person, which is not very often, but whenever she did, she says, that person is so fat. You are so fat. Well, that's something you ought not to say, even though it's true. So I think that Jonathan probably should not have said anything, but he did. But he was speaking the truth. We go now to 1 Samuel 14, verses 31 through 34. The Israelites struck down the Philistines that day from Michmash all the way to Ajalon. I mentioned that earlier. That's about a 12-mile east-to-west piece of Benjamin that they are fighting on. Since the Israelites were completely exhausted, they rushed to the plunder, took sheep, cattle, and calves, slaughtered them on the ground, and ate meat with the blood still in it. So this was after the day had passed. The oath was no longer in effect, because Saul said, nobody's going to eat before the sun goes down. Well, the sun's down now, and they're eating, and they're hungry. And they rushed at it. They rushed to the plunder, took sheep, cattle, and calves, slaughtered them on the ground, and ate meat with the blood still in it. Which, of course, is a no-no. Verse 33, some reported to Saul, look, the troops are sinning against the Lord by eating meat with the blood still in it. Saul said, you have been unfaithful. Roll a large stone over here at once. He then said, go among the troops and say to them, each man must bring me his ox or his sheep. Do the slaughtering here, and then you can eat. Don't sin against the Lord by eating meat with the blood in it. Well, Saul knew enough of the law to know that that was not a good thing, to eat meat with the blood in it. by bringing the captured animals to that stone there, they could watch the blood run to the ground. They could know that the meat doesn't have the blood in it. The animal is dead, no problem, and they could eat it. So Saul does something good there. Now let's take a little geographical rabbit trail and look at Aijalon, A-I-J-A-L-O-N, which means place of deer. That's the famous place where Joshua made the sun and the moon stand still. It was a little bit west of the hill country of Ephraim. It was a place that Joshua went after he passed through the passes of Beth Horon and went south a little bit and went to Aijalon. So it's a famous place. So let's see what Easton says about it. A town and valley originally assigned to the tribe of Dan, from which, however, they could not drive the Amorites. It was one of the Levitical cities given to the Kohathites. That's one of the families of the Levites. It was not far from Beth Shemesh. That's the famous place, first landing place in Israel that the ark went to when the Philistines got tired of keeping the ark because it was giving them hemorrhoids and mice in the field. So Aijalon was not far from Beth Shemesh. It was the boundary between the kingdoms of Judah and Israel and is frequently mentioned in Jewish history. With reference to the valley named after the town, Joshua uttered the celebrated command, "Sun, stand thou still on Gibeon, and thou, moon, in the valley of Aijalon." All right, in verse 32, we see that the Israelites rushed to the plunder. That's because they were hungry. At nightfall, after Saul's oath was inoperable, the NASB says that they rushed greedily to the plunder. They hadn't eaten all day, so they ate ravenously. They were so hungry, they ate the meat raw with the blood in it, and this is ironic, because they were very strict here about not violating Saul's man-made oath to not eat before the sun went down, but they were very slack about disobeying God's divine law. And all I can say about this is that hunger will make men forget just about everything. Now, the scripture was very clear about not eating blood. Saul, who was not very tight on the law or morality in his life, he understood that because it was everywhere in Jewish law and Jewish culture. Genesis 9:4, I'm going to read 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 verses. Genesis 9:4, only you, talking to Noah, shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, its blood, because blood is life, life is in the blood, so you don't eat flesh with blood in it. Leviticus 3:17, it is a perpetual statute throughout your generations and all your dwellings. You shall not eat any fat or any blood. Leviticus 7, verse 26 through 27. You are not to eat any blood, either of bird or animal, in any of your dwellings. Any person who eats any blood, even that person shall be cut off from his people, i.e. executed. Leviticus 17:10 through 11, and any man from the house of Israel or from the aliens who sojourn among them who eats any blood, I will set my face against that person who eats blood and will cut him off from among the people, for the life of the flesh is in the blood, and I have given it to you on the altar to make atonement for your souls, for it is the blood by reason of the life that makes atonement. Leviticus 19, verse 26, first part of the verse. You shall not eat anything with the blood. So, it's very clear. No blood eating. Now, this stone that Saul set up, I mentioned it was so the animals could be slaughtered on the stone and the blood drained properly so they could eat the meat properly. That's one reason, but also it might have been to offer sacrifices as atonement for the sin of eating animals with the blood in it. The scripture is not clear. It could be both. They drained the blood and then they sacrificed the animals to cover their sin. The text doesn't say. That's a reasonable speculation, though. Paul said, bring those animals here. Bring that stone here. That's so Saul could keep his eye on them. Saul still has respect for the law at this point. We go now to 1 Samuel 14, verse 35. And Saul built an altar to the Lord. It was the first altar that he built to the Lord. Now, why did Saul build this altar? Could it be for peace offerings and thanks for recent victory over the Philistines? Remember, a thank offering is a type of a peace offering, and he had just won a big victory. Good time to give thanks. It could have been for sin offerings that he built an altar because the people had eaten animals with the blood in it. He wanted to cover their sin. Could be both. Now, this altar could have been that stone that was previously mentioned where the animals were being sacrificed. So the blood could be drained properly, or it could be a new altar built for the occasion. We don't know. Now, this was the first altar that Saul had built. Samuel had built all the altars previously. Saul probably felt he had sufficient authority to erect one himself now. He's starting to feel his oats as king. He's won two battles, the battle against Nahash at Jabesh-Gilead and the Ammonites, and now the battle at Michmash. Remember, Saul previously, as they were mustering for this battle at Michmash at Gilgal, in the previous chapter, chapter 13, Saul had offered a sacrifice without waiting on Samuel. course, that was bad. Samuel chastised him for it, said he was not going to have the kingdom forever because of it. It was a serious breach. But Saul didn't seem to worry about erecting an altar for sacrifice now, even though Samuel was not there. I guess so. He had done it at Gilgal. Why not do it now? He's king. He's going to be priestly as well as kingly. 1 Samuel 14, verses 36 through 38. Then Saul said, "Let us go down after the Philistines by night and take spoil among them until the morning light, and let us not leave a man of them." And they said, "Do whatever seems good to you." So the priest said, "Let us draw near to God here." Saul inquired of God, "Shall I go down after the Philistines? Will you give them into the hand of Israel?" But he did not answer him on that day. Saul said, "Draw near here, all you chiefs of the people, and investigate and see how this sin has happened today." So now Saul is exhorting his soldiers to go on a night operation. Take spoil. He wouldn't let them eat during the day. So now he says, "Well, stay up all night and you can eat all you want, and you can take all the spoil you want." He's already asked his men to fight all day without food, and now he's asking them to go on a night march. What a general this guy is. I would have hated to have fought in his army. But the people are very compliant. They said, "Do whatever seems good to you, Saul." We're going to find out just a little bit later. They can be pushed so far, but no further. They're going to basically have a palace revolt against their good king, Saul. But right now, they're compliant, and so they say, "Okay, we'll do it." So then in verse 36, the priest said, "Let us draw near to God here." And of course, the purpose of drawing near to God is to ask him some advice. What are we going to do here? Now, who is this priest? We read about him in verse 3 of this chapter 14. Ahijah, who was wearing an ephod, was also there. He was the son of Ahitub, the brother of Ichabod, son of Phinehas, son of Eli, the Lord's priest at Shiloh. He's in the house of Ithamar. He's the priest that's now currently officiating under Saul. So Saul, in verse 37, uses Ahijah to inquire of the Lord. When you see inquire of the Lord, that means the Urim and Thummim. Remember, there's the ephod, which is the little vest that is worn on top of the tunic by the high priest. And then in front of the ephod, there is a folded breastplate with the 12 stones. And then inside the breastplate, there's the Urim and Thummim. And people don't know exactly what the Urim and Thummim is. Lots of speculations, but it's somehow they inquired of the Lord. I always like to think of it as a black stone and a white stone. Shall we go chase the Philistines? Oh, we drew out a white stone. God's saying, yes, go chase them. Oh, we drew out a black stone? No, don't go chase them. Somehow, the system was worked out so that they could get direction from the Lord. But in verse 37, at the end of the verse, it says, "He, Yahweh, did not answer him," did not answer Saul on that day. So heaven is cut off from Saul. I guess my little story about the black stone and the white stone wouldn't really fit here, because you're always going to get an answer if you draw a white stone or a black stone, but that's not the important thing. How it was done, that it was done and there was no answer is important. Saul has been cut off from the direction and the voice of the Lord. And I suspect it was because Saul is a sinful man. Sinful people don't hear the voice of the Lord. They directly cut themselves off from hearing from God. So Saul says in verse 38, "Look here, draw near here, all you chiefs of the people, and investigate and see how this sin has happened today." What sin is he talking about? Well, there must be some kind of sin, because God's not answering with the Urim and Thummim. Now, there are three things that Saul never contemplated might be the sin that had caused this opaqueness, this lack of communication from God. The first thing could have been his rash oath that no one could eat. He didn't blame that. The second thing he didn't blame was the people's eating of the meat with blood still in it. That could have had something to do with the fact that God hadn't answered. He didn't mention his earlier refusal to wait 7 days for Samuel at Gilgal as they were mustering for the Battle of Michmash. Nope, he didn't say, no, that's not what it is. Somebody has done some kind of sin. Now, the thing that Saul was contemplating most probably here about what that sin was, somebody had violated that oath that he had put on the people. Don't eat until the sun comes down. So what he's done, he is blaming the violators of the oath rather than the author of the oath himself, because it was a stupid oath. Now here's an interesting query. Was Jonathan's eating of the honey a sin that would cause God not to answer? Well, there's two ways you can look at that. You could say, no, Jonathan's act was not a sin because he didn't know. There was an oath that said he couldn't eat, and I think that's obviously the answer. Adam Clark agrees with me. He says, quote, "Surely Jonathan's eating the honey was no sin. This could not have excited God's displeasure." Well, now other people say it was a sin because the lot picked out Jonathan. Remember, they drew lots, and it was Jonathan that did it. And God's in control of the lot, so therefore God must have said that Jonathan had sinned. Adam Clark argues against that by saying, look, no. Jonathan was delivered by the people from his father's curse, so if he had sinned, he wasn't punished for the sin. We'll see Jonathan being delivered in just a minute. Second reason Clark argues that Jonathan did not sin, because the lot picked him out as the one who ate the honey, no propitiatory sacrifice was offered to God for pardon for this alleged sin of Jonathan. And the third thing that Clark alleges in defense of Jonathan, God showed no displeasure on the occasion. It's an argument from silence, but it's a pretty good argument. Really, all three put together, no, Jonathan didn't sin, just because the lot picked him out. The lot picked out who had done it. The lot did not say that what was done was a sin. We go now to 1 Samuel 14, verses 39 through 40. Saul continues, as surely as the Lord lives who saves Israel, even if it is because of my son Jonathan, he must die. Not one of the troops answered him. So he said to all Israel, you will be on one side, and I and my son Jonathan will be on the other side. And the troops replied, do whatever you want. Now, of course, when you see those magic words, as surely as the Lord lives, that's a sacred oath, a solemn oath before God. One asks, is that another rash oath? It certainly sounds like a rash oath to me. I'm going to kill my son if he ate honey before the sun went down. Now, why did Saul mention Jonathan as a possible culprit? It's because he knew already that Jonathan was guilty, as Gil said. Somebody had to have told him by now. Well, then the question arises, well, why did not Saul just accuse Jonathan straight away and said, you did it? Jonathan would say, yes, I did do it. And Saul says, well, you're going to have to die. Why go through all this lot drawing and public ascertainment of whether as to who did the sin? Well, Saul wanted to show a strict regard for justice. He wanted to say, I'm king. The law is above people. I will even execute my own son if the law is broken. What a king. Not one of the troops answered. Why not? Well, first of all, they knew that Jonathan broke the oath innocently. Jonathan did not know of the oath when he ate the honey, and all the troops knew it. They also knew who had won the victory that day. It wasn't this blustering King Saul who had won. It was Jonathan who won the battle against the Philistines when he and the armor bearer went through the valley before Michmash climbed up the crags and induced panic in the Philistine camp. That was Jonathan, not Saul. So the troops kept silent. They weren't going to turn Jonathan in. Now the next question is why did Saul say, all right, the troops, you be on one side and I and Jonathan on the other side? Why did Saul divide the people that way? John Gill says it's because he knew what Jonathan had done, and he expected the lot to fall on Jonathan and not on the troops, and so he'd separated out Jonathan from the troops. In other words, he was kind of rigging the lot drawing in advance. And maybe what's happening here is Saul is putting the leadership of Israel on one side, that would be Saul and Jonathan, and the soldiers on the other side, so that when the lot fell on the leadership, namely on Jonathan, then justice would appear to be entirely blind. Oh, okay, we had this objective lot drawn by God, and it shows up on Jonathan, so I'm not picking on Jonathan, and I'm not trying to protect Jonathan. Justice did it. God did it. God showed that Jonathan is the guilty party. Verse 40, after Saul makes that division, the troops reply, do whatever you want. The people had become very obsequious to Saul by now, and this shows that Saul at this point had consolidated his power. But we're going to find out in just a little bit that the people are finally going to get their back up and say, no more, Saul, no further. We go now to verses 41 through 43 of 1 Samuel 14. Therefore, Saul said to the Lord, the God of Israel, give a perfect lot. And Jonathan and Saul were taken. But the people escaped. That means they escaped from the lot. So now the troops know that they're not going to get blamed for eating honey before the oath was over, before the day was over. So now they had to, in verse 42, Saul said, cast lots between me and Jonathan, my son, and Jonathan was taken. So Jonathan is now exposed by the lot to be the one who ate the honey. Verse 43, then Saul said to Jonathan, tell me what you have done. So Jonathan told him and said, I indeed tasted a little honey with the end of the staff that was in my hand. Here I am. I must die. Well, all of this lot-taking shows that Saul is following strict justice. He included himself in the lot, even though he was king. Now, Saul is showing the people that he is totally confident of being innocent. Otherwise, he wouldn't have put himself under the lot, because kings normally wouldn't do that. Yeah, so the form of all this is very nice, very proper. but the whole thing is stupid. Now, when Jonathan was caught by the lot, he immediately confessed, eating the honey, and said, "Here I am, I must die." Now, the first thing we know here is that Jonathan doesn't allude to the one fact that would mitigate his so-called crime. He didn't know about the oath. And that's the first thing I would have said, but Daddy King, Father King, I didn't know about your dumb oath. I wouldn't have said it quite that bluntly, but that's what I would have said. I said, "Look, I didn't know about the oath." And he might have said, "Yeah, and besides, was that oath really smart? Maybe this falls in the legal category of a rash oath, which should have been abjured so that the people could beat the Philistines and could eat." But he doesn't say anything about how bad the oath was, and he doesn't even say that he didn't know about the oath. Verse 43, according to the NESB and the Holman Christian Study Bible, Jonathan says, "I must die." He just gives himself up to Saul to be killed. But the NIV translates it this way, "And now must I die?" Which gives a quite a different picture than the NASB and the Holman Christian Study Bible and also the KJV. "And now must I die?" In other words, how can you put me to death for this? So maybe his subjection to Saul might not have been quite abject as some translations seem to imply. Now the question might be asked, why would God make the lot come out on Jonathan, who's an innocent man? Well, here's a way to answer that. There were a lot of good things that followed from this lot. First of all, it was shown publicly that Jonathan had not known of Saul's oath. Well, I don't know how it's shown publicly. Jonathan never admitted it. Maybe that's implied. Maybe the people just knew it. But it did show that the people loved Jonathan, and it showed Saul how foolishly he had acted in making the oath to start with. Well, I don't know. Did Saul really admit to himself that he was wrong? He might have been showed that it was foolish when the people said in the next couple of verses, they're going to say, "No, not of a hair, Jonathan's head's going to fall to the ground." So, again, that oath showed who took that lot, showed who took the honey. It doesn't say that Jonathan was a guilty person for doing it. We go now to 1 Samuel 14, verses 44 through 45. Saul declared to him, to Jonathan, "May God punish me and do so severely if you do not die, Jonathan." Oh, that's some fatherly affection. But the people said to Saul, "Must Jonathan die who accomplished such a great deliverance for Israel? No, as the Lord lives, not a hair of his head will fall to the ground, for he worked with God's help today." So the people redeemed Jonathan, and he did not die. Now notice in verse 44 that Saul not only said that he wanted to kill his son Jonathan, he also said he took an oath, "May God punish me and do so severely." In other words, "May God kill me if you don't die, Jonathan. It's either me or you, Jonathan. Either you're going to die or I'm going to die." Saul imprecated himself with death. What a king. Verse 45, but the people said to Saul, "Must Jonathan die, who accomplished such a great deliverance for Israel?" Well, Saul was interested in saving his rash oath. The people were interested in saving Jonathan. Saul's desire to uphold his kingly authority certainly trumped his paternal affection. Saul does not come out looking good here. The people took an oath, too. Saul took an oath, "May God punish me," and that was an oath. But the people said, "No, as the Lord lives," that's an oath. That's a formulaic way of taking an oath. So the people counter Saul's oath with another oath of their own. And they said, "No, not a hair of Jonathan's head will fall to the ground." John Gill says this, quote, "They speak of it," the oath, Saul's oath that he's going to kill Jonathan. "They speak of it with the utmost abhorrence and detestation as a shocking piece of cruelty and ingratitude, unheard of and not to be paralleled." Well, exactly. So now the people are not acting obsequiously as they had done just recently, the previous couple of verses. Now they're really provoked about the thought of Jonathan dying. This uprising of the people is an example of how an aroused populace can blunt despotic sovereigns. I'm thinking of certain sovereigns in the United States of America, the land of the free, formerly the land of the free and the home of the brave. We go down to 1 Samuel chapter 14, verses 46 through 48. Then Saul gave up the pursuit of the Philistines, and the Philistines returned to their own territory. When Saul assumed the kingship over Israel, he fought against all his enemies in every direction, against Moab, the Ammonites, Edom, the kings of Zobah, and the Philistines. Wherever he turned, he caused havoc. He fought bravely, defeated the Amalekites, and delivered Israel from the hand of those who plundered him. Well, Saul's starting out his kingship here very nicely. He has already beaten Nahash the Ammonite at Jabesh Gilead. That was his first battle. Now he's won Michmash against the Philistines, and now he's beaten everybody. Moab, that's east of the Dead Sea, roughly is Moab. The Ammonites, that's east of the Jordan River, roughly where Gilead is. To the north of Gilead, of course, is the southern area of Manasseh. To the south, southern part of Gilead, down to roughly the northern tip of the Dead Sea, that's the Ammonites. Edom, who is south of Moab, south of the southern tip of the Dead Sea, on both sides of the Arabah Valley, there is Edom. The kings of Zobah, though that is a Syrian kingdom, north of Israel and south of Koiler, Syria, which is the area between the Lebanon and anti-Lebanon ranges. So right north of Israel, the kings of Zobah, and of course the Philistines, which we've been talking about, he beat them all. But that's after he'd assumed the kingship after the Battle of Michmash in verse 46. Saul gave up the pursuit of the Philistines, and the Philistines returned to their own territory. Now what that means is, the Philistines were not wiped out here. Saul, if he'd have wiped them out at Michmash, if he'd have won a huge battle, it might have been the Philistines had left him alone the rest of his reign. But instead, Saul is going to be fighting the Philistines for the rest of his reign. He got no answer from the Urim and Thummim when he inquired as to whether he should chase the Philistines. And so he said, okay, boom, I'm going home. He lost the opportunity to chase the Philistines by taking the time to cast the lots. If he had just chased them instead of casting lots to find out who broke his stupid rash oath, if he had chased them down, he wouldn't have had the Philistines probably to deal with the whole rest of his monarchy. So Saul, instead of chasing the Philistines, probably goes back to his hometown of Gibeah, and then he assumes the kingship, and so far it starts out nicely as he beats all the pagan tribes around. Now, when it says he assumed the kingship, that sounds like he didn't have it before, and then he assumed it. Actually, he was already king. That word there could mean that the Philistines had the kingdom, and he assumed the kingship over the Philistines. Or it could be just that Saul started acting like a king before. He was a timid rustic, a farmer. The Philistines had him cowed, but now, and in fact, there were people who grumbled about Saul taking power in 1 Samuel 10:27. But some wicked men said, how can this guy save us? They despised him and did not bring him a gift. Well, Saul had gone from that abject state to a military victor, and so now he's assuming the kingship by acting like a king. Now, in verse 48, Saul is said to have fought bravely, defeating the Amalekites. And before that, he's fought against Moab, Ammon, Edom, and Zobah. Well, what does that mean, fought against? Was he merely acting defensively against incursions in Israel, or was he actually being on the offense, going on the offense and attacking surrounding nations? Jameson Fawcett and Brown says that Saul had made, quote, successful incursions against various hostile neighbors, whom he harassed, though he did not subdue them. So, raids, incursions, defensive battles, we don't know, but Saul had their king, Israel had their king, and the king was doing the job of protecting them militarily, which is what the Israelites wanted. Even though God and Samuel said, no, the judge could have done the same thing, but no, you got to have a king. Well, he was doing his job. That's the good news, but it's not going to end up nice. The Philistines are going to end up winning. At the Battle of Gilboa, when Saul and Jonathan are killed. Now, the last pagan tribe that Saul is listed here as having defeated are the Amalekites. Now, these guys are interesting, and they show up everywhere, so I'm going to read some from Easton's about the Amalekites. They were a tribe that dwelt in Arabia Petraea. That's the southern part of Israel, the Sinai Peninsula, the northern part of the Sinai Peninsula, the desert of Shur, the desert that separates Egypt from Israel. Best way to remember Arabia Petraea is between the dead and the red, between the Dead Sea and the Red Sea, between the Gulf of Aqaba all the way up to the Dead Sea, that area in there. The Amalekites lived there. Numbers 13:29. They dwelt in the land of the south. I'm reading from Easton's. They dwelt in the land of the south from Havilah until thou comest to Shur. Shur is the desert between Egypt and Israel. Havilah people are not too sure. Some people think it's the southern end of the desert area between the Persian Gulf, which is where Babylon was, all the way over to the Arabian Gulf, the Gulf of Aqaba, the Suez Gulf, that area, Mount Sinai, that southern end of that desert between the Jordan and the Euphrates River. But who knows? It's somewhere in the south, in the desert regions down there. Easton's continues, they were a pastoral and hence a nomadic race. Their kings bore the hereditary name of Agag. They attempted to stop the Israelites when they marched through their territory, attacking them at Rephidim. That's within the first month or two of the Exodus, if I recall, before they got to Sinai. They afterwards attacked the Israelites at Hormah, which means destruction. We read of them, this is on the Exodus, we read of them subsequently as in league with the Moabites. That's when they're in the plains of Moab, getting ready to cross over right before Moses died. That's the famous story of the zeal of Phinehas, who stabbed Zimri and Cosby, who were having illicit sex in a tent. Well, we often think of the Midianites and the Moabites in that situation, but it also says the Amalekites were joined with them then. So the Amalekites always hanging around as an enemy of Israel. And then, of course, the Midianites, that's with Gideon. We think about Gideon fighting the Midianites, but it says that the Midianites were allied with the Amalekites. So they're everywhere. They're constantly fighting Israel. Saul finally desolated their territory and destroyed their power, and David recovered booty from them. They're mentioned in Babylonian inscriptions. They're called Sute, S-U-T-E, the Egyptian inscriptions as Sitiu. And the Amarna tablets include them under the general name of Kabati, or plunderers. These were some bad people. And Saul, he didn't finally wipe them out, but he hastened the process along until David came and took some booty from them, and they finally disappear. These were a people that Israel, by the law of God, were bound to destroy and blot out their names, as one of my commentators. And we're going to see a war against the Amalekites in our very next chapter in 1 Samuel 15, first 7 verses. We go now to 1 Samuel chapter 14, verse 49. Now the sons of Saul were Jonathan and Ishvi and Malchishua. And the names of his two daughters were these, the name of the firstborn, Merab, and the name of the younger, Michal. Now three sons are mentioned here in this verse, verse 49, but there's another son who's going to take over the kingdom when Saul dies. His name is Ishbosheth, also known as Eshbaal. We read about him in 2 Samuel 2, verse 8, but Abner, the son of Ner, commander of Saul's army, had taken Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim. So there's Ishbosheth. He's not mentioned here. And we also read in 1 Chronicles 8:33, Ner became the father of Kish, Kish became the father of Saul, Saul became the father of Jonathan, Melchishua, Eshbaal, that's Ishbosheth, he's mentioned there, and also another son named Abinadab. Well, Abinadab's the same son as Ishvi. So we're going to call Ishvi, also known as Abinadab. Now, right here in 1 Samuel 14, Ishbosheth is not mentioned. Why not? Well, some say it's because he succeeded as king. It's not necessary to mention him there. Well, that's a strange reason. It could be he was not mentioned here because he's the only one who didn't die with Saul at war. The other three that are listed, namely Jonathan and Malchishua and Ishvi, also known as Abinadab, they all died with Solomon in the famous Battle of Gilboa, which we'll get to eventually. He's not mentioned, but he was too young to go to war. That's why he wasn't there. In fact, that's why he was named king. He was the only surviving son. But Clark objects to this reason for Ishbosheth not being mentioned here. He said, well, why then mention Saul's daughters and his wife? Did they go with him to the war? No, they didn't, but they're mentioned in the genealogy. What's the point? Despite Clark's objection, John Gill says it seems to be the majority opinion that the reason Ishbosheth is not mentioned here is because he didn't die in the war. Actually, that makes a lot of sense to me. Another reason might be is because these are the only three sons of Ahinoam, Saul's wife, who's mentioned in the next verse. These were not the sons of another wife. These are Ahinoam's sons. And that's another possible reason. There's a problem with that. Nowhere do we read of Saul having another wife. However, he did have a concubine, so I don't know. I don't know why Ishbosheth is not mentioned, but he's not. Doesn't really matter. Now, the name of the two daughters were Merab and Michal. Merab was married to Adriel the Maholathite. You say, well, so what? Well, let's read that. 1 Samuel 18:19. So it came about at that time when Merab, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, that she was given to Adriel the Maholathite for a wife. That's why she's kind of famous. She was the wife that David never got, and he should have gotten. We'll read about that when we get to 1 Samuel 18. And then, of course, there's the famous Michal. She became one of David's wives. 1 Samuel 18:27. David rose up and went, he and his men, and he struck down 200 men among the Philistines. Then David brought their foreskins, and they gave them in full number to the king, that he might become the king's son-in-law. So Saul gave him Michal, his daughter, for a wife. So that was Michal's bride price. 200 foreskins of Philistines. Whew. How'd you like to say that your wife, my wife, is worth 200 foreskins? 200 foreskins of penises. Well, Michal, as it turned out, despised David because Saul got so excited when the ark was brought back into Jerusalem. He's dancing around, and Michal said, hey, what you doing dancing around like that? We'll get to that story later, too. So anyway, Merab and Michal are going to show up later. So we go now to verses 50 through 52 of 1 Samuel 14. The name of Saul's wife was Ahinoam, the daughter of Ahimaaz. And the name of the captain of his army was Abner, the son of Ner, Saul's uncle. Ner is Saul's uncle, by the way, not Abner. Abner is Saul's first cousin. Abner, the son of Ner, who was Saul's uncle. Kish was the father of Saul, and Ner, the father of Abner, was the son of Abiel. Now the war against the Philistines was severe all the days of Saul, and when Saul saw any mighty man or any valiant man, he attached him to his staff. All right, Saul's wife was Ahinoam. We don't know too much about her, but she was the mother of the three sons that we just mentioned in the previous verse, namely Jonathan, Ishvi, also known as Aminadab, and Malchishua. She's their mother. And the name of the captain of the army was Abner. Now, let me just give you a brief family tree here. We've got Ner, Senior, who's not listed here. He's somewhere up in the genealogy. And as he's either the father of Abiel, the grandfather, whatever, the ancestor of Abiel. Now, Abiel was the father of Kish and Ner, Jr. So Kish and Ner, Jr. are brothers. Kish is the father of Saul. Ner, Jr. is the father of Abner. Therefore, Saul and Abner are first cousins. Now, verse 52 says the war against the Philistines was severe all the days of Saul. He had a chance to wipe them out. I think he did. I mean, maybe he didn't, but he could have done a lot more damage. But he was screwing around with his stupid oaths and finding out he was guilty and being an idiot king. And so he ended up fighting the Philistines with the whole rest of his monarchy. So that's the story of Saul's kingship. It was a military kingship. He's looking for soldiers. Generals, anytime he found a mighty man or a valiant man, he attached him to his staff. He says, come fight for me. Some people say that might have been his bodyguard, but I don't think so. I think his staff is a better translation. That's what NASB has. In other words, he needed military help. Adam Clark says this was a very wise thing that Saul did. I think it probably was. So Saul's not all bad, but he's not exactly a paradigm of kingly righteousness. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished 1 Samuel 14. We are now prepared to go to 1 Samuel 15, verses 1 through 35. We will see the Lord rejecting Saul. I hope you stay tuned for that sad story, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.